Hello, what's going on? My name is Rich Ryan. This is the Reinforced Running Podcast. Today we are bringing you a Torque Talk featuring athlete Jamie Brusa. And Jamie is a Spartan Pro Team member. She has 12th place finishes in 2019 at the Spartan World Championships and Spartan North American Championships. She's a former Division I runner. She's a current collegiate coach. And she's a quantitative biologist with a focus on marine sciences. So shout out to all the manatee lovers out there. So Jamie is as well thought out in her approach as any athlete I've ever spoken to. So we talk about a lot, including some of Jamie's background as an athlete and the things that she has learned about her training and what works specifically for her, how she implements strategies for race day that legitimately work, and why she's seen such good progression year over year as an athlete and why she continues to get better at obstacle course racing. So it's a great conversation. Jamie's awesome. She's definitely one to look out for in 2021. So let's do it. Jamie Brusa. So I'm excited to kind of dive in. You have this really interesting background. You've kind of floated around and done a lot of really cool, interesting things. And I do want to kind of dive into them and how you've managed to like work being a high level athlete in with your career and coaching. And I think there's going to be a lot of cool like takeaways from that. But before we kind of dive in, I want to just give people an idea of who you are, like where you are, like, where do you currently live and train right now?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the kind words first, but, I'm in Bozeman, Montana. I've been here, I think this is my fifth year living here. Had a nice tour of the country before that for various reasons.
I remember when we first started talking and you kind of explained to me how you ended up in Montana. You're like, I lived there for a little bit and then I bounced around some more. And then Montana is just the best place. So I decided to come back. So why wouldn't I live there? Why is it so awesome in Montana?
Well, I guess I'll qualify by saying it's probably not awesome for everybody because it definitely gets quite chilly here in the winters. So you kind of have to be able to endure cold temperatures and a lot of snow. I really enjoy the community here. My husband and I have lived in Missoula previously and we're in Bozeman now. So those are two communities that are very geared towards outdoor living and a lot of active lifestyles. Running is huge in both of those towns. So you're not a weirdo if you're out running through the neighborhoods. People are generally aware of other people out running and they'll stop at the crosswalks if they see you. And, it's a more friendly atmosphere. People have pretty good trail etiquette out here. So I definitely like that. And then, just kind of the community feel is something that I never really had growing up. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. And so it's just a lot of people and a lot of people who are very competitive. And so there's not quite as much of that friendliness that we get out here and actually most other places in the US.
Yeah. It's interesting. And like, how did you realize that that was the case, that it had this community that was like supportive and something you wanted to be around? Something that I've had struggles with other parts of the country where people are nice. Like here, they're not nice in Philadelphia, but like, at least you know where you stand. Other places, they seem to be nice, but like, I don't quite believe them. I'm like, are you really being nice? So how did but it sounds like where you are, it is very authentic and people are like genuinely nice. Like, how did that click? And when did you realize that that was like important for you, that you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, this is a place that I like to be and like be around.
Yeah, it just sort of happened. We didn't really realize that people could be really genuinely nice. I grew up, like I said, near Chicago. My husband grew up just outside of DC. So those are two places where like the pace of life is really fast. And people can certainly be friendly and kind, but if you're just down the street walking by strangers and you're trying to get to your building and you've got a short amount of time to get there, you don't have time to be interested in other people's lives if you don't know them. And right when we moved to Missoula, this was 6, 7, maybe 8 years ago. Shoot, time is going so fast. But You're just like on the sidewalk downtown and someone was saying hi. And my husband was like on his defenses because nobody does that in DC. And he's like, oh, shoot, what do you want? And the guy was like, no, I'm just saying hi. How's it going? And so I think at that moment it was like, oh, this is a very different place. And when we were looking to move to Missoula, there were some people we didn't even know, just like, my husband was going for another degree. And so some people in the department at the university were looking at places to rent to help us find a place since we weren't out there. And, you know, that was a really kind thing to do, to take their own time to help us out. So just little things like that kept making their way into our general everyday lives. And we're like, okay, this is a very different kind of community. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, because I get what you're saying. And I feel like I'd have that same type of reaction. It's like, okay, like, what is it? What's in it for you to treat me this way? Like, there has right. to be something going on. But it sounds like it's just, they're just genuinely interested and like want to be. And it's probably just to do with like facilitating that community, right? Like, if we can just foster this, like, and this is a place where we want to live, and if it can be a friendly and nice, kind place, and we can all agree upon that's how we want to act, like that's how we can kind of present ourselves to new people that we meet. Is real estate going crazy out there now? Because it seems like it, like the idea of Montana seems to be really attractive to people in probably more urban areas now post pandemic. What's that like? Have you been noticing that? Has it gone nuts?
Yeah, it's really tough. It's been pretty crazy the entirety of us living in Bozeman. When we first moved here, we came from Greeley, Colorado, which also has a pretty good market if you're a seller, and really difficult market if you're a buyer. And we were looking to buy a house there. And when we moved, we're like, oh, it's going to be so much easier. Nothing could be worse than Greeley. And we come into Bozeman and we're looking for a place to rent, and it's really tough. We couldn't actually find a place for about the first 6 months we were here. We stayed with friends who were a few towns over, and they were very nice, and we were very lucky to be able to do that. So I'm not sure what we would have done otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's crept into the rental market, which drives those prices up. And so we're hoping to buy a house somewhat in the nearish future. And we were actually just looking at the plots of home prices, like median home prices over the last, I think it went from 2012 to present. And it's just this exponential curve in Bozeman. It's really bad. And then with the pandemic, Montana was pretty safe for a long time. And then I think, like you were saying, that was very attractive to people, and that brought in more people. And yeah, I think there's something about the idea of just the word Montana gets people excited, and they think we're all unicorns out here or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I want to be part of that.
Right. Like, I honestly have no idea. I have no idea what it would be like, but that's what it seems like. It's like, okay, if I don't have to live in this area where my work is going to be from now on, like, let's go explore other places. Let's step out of what is typical and like, the urban environment. So yeah, it seems like it's going to probably keep going up for a while, which is a bummer for those looking to buy.
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of interesting because Montana is definitely not for everybody. I mean, I mentioned the weather earlier, but it's also like, if you're used to a larger metropolitan area, it's a very different lifestyle change, because if you want to go to 20 different box stores to try and compare prices on a product, that's not an option. You might have one of those in your town or in the next 50 miles from your town. And the towns don't really bleed into each other. They're kind of on these isolated islands. And so, yeah, it's an adjustment for some people moving out here. And I know some people have taken to the lifestyle really easily and they love it. And others are, they don't even last a year out here, and then they move back to wherever they came from or try something new.
Yeah, the idea and the application, they don't always match up, especially when it comes to lifestyle stuff. But I could see how it would be an attractive thing. So with it being so harsh for a lot of the year, right? Like when does like winter like start and stop? Like November to like April? Like, is it a huge chunk? Like when can you count on it being not super cold and snowy?
Yeah. Well, we pretty much always get snow at least once in September.
Okay.
And then October's kind of variable. Like we'll get snow a few times. The past couple of years we've had below zero temperatures for like a week or half a week, maybe in October. But then we've also had upper 60s to 70s in the same year, in the same month. So it can be really variable. And then November through March is generally pretty chilly, but we get little blips of hope in March. And then I always think it's going to keep getting warmer. And then April comes in and then we get like a few good snows in April. And then I usually hate April because I'm ready for spring weather. And then May is usually good. Sometimes there's no snow in May, but usually we get one or two snows. And then we could get snow in June, but it's only once, maybe twice. And then I've never seen it snow in July or August, but it can snow in town in all 12 months.
That's insane. I was like trying to count off the months in my head. I was like, she's going to say them all. They're going to all come. So how does that affect your training? Like, I know you don't necessarily love the cold. So like, does that hurt your training especially in the really cold months? I'm guessing it gets like below zero and gets well under there. And like, there is snow. So it's like, has to be hard to navigate like where you can go. How do you kind of manage that with the training that you're doing?
It definitely keeps me on my toes. I would say that the biggest thing is just that you can't really get on trails. I mean, you kind of can if you throw on some micro spikes and just kind of deal with the snow and the ice. But for the most part, if you want to get in a solid training run, a lot of the runs in the wintertime are going to be on the streets in town. So that makes things usually pretty flat. It gets icy, sometimes it's snowy. Compared to Illinois, Montana is not very good at clearing the roads, but in their defense, they have way more snow than Illinois. So, and that's really my metric just because I've spent so much time living in Illinois. But so yeah, there's a lot of running on snow, which is actually kind of good because it's not as hard of a surface as just straight up cement or asphalt. So I think that can be helpful for saving the legs, but at the same time, the snow can move. And so you're activating all these other muscles for stability, which also could be beneficial. And I think in absence of being on a trail, you still do get some of that agility training from the ice and just the movable snow.
Yeah, because it's like both ways. When you're talking about those surfaces that are going to be a little bit unpredictable, it's clearly going to be harder to get to like your maximum output when it comes to like a running workout, right? Like you can't go as fast or run as hard as you can. But for obstacle course racing, you kind of need to have that. Like you're never really going to get to the point where you're full on pressed. And like a kid on like a road 5K or road 10K, it's going to be more like running on snow or mud or whatever. It's like where you're kind of having to like watch where you're going or slipping up here or there. And for you, you came from that background of like roads and track. Like you're a Division I runner at University of Illinois and you're mostly mid distance, right? You're 800 and up, but did some cross country.
Yeah, I did the 800 for most of my time. And then I decided I just wasn't really improving much. I was really consistent, but I wanted to break through and get faster. And at one point my senior year, my coach and I were just like, let's maybe try something else. So then I moved into the 1500 for my last, outdoor season. It was my last season at Illinois. And I had a year of eligibility from injury that I took as a first year master's student in South Carolina.
How'd the adjustment go? I mean, that's a lot because did you run cross all 4 years too? Or did you come into cross later? Okay. So you did cross, just kind of put a base of training in so that when it came to indoor, you could just start turning it over. More or less. So how did the 1500 go in the in that spring of your senior year?
I loved it. Unfortunately, I think it took me the whole season, and maybe I could have used more than that, to really understand how that race works and really how to know how to race it. But I think it's a really cool race, just the distance of it. It's not so fast as the 800, but there's still a lot of, it's more a very narrow margin for error. You kind of have to get moving, and, you know, if you conserve too much at the beginning, then you've kind of blown your race.
It's funny that there is nuance to something that's so short like that. The 800, nuance is probably not the best way to describe that. That's just kind of like making sure you get out and just hammer and hang and just like put yourself in a position to like not die, I guess. But like even this past fall when I was doing some mile like time trialing on my own, I did a couple in succession, and I had so much room to like think about ways to kind of change and move things around, which was interesting. I didn't think it was going to be that way. I was like, I don't know, you just run hard until you can, until it's over. But then after you came out of, and it seems like looking at some of your OCR progress, it seems like the longer events do pretty well for you. Was that something that you thought would happen, like based on your background, where it was basically like the shortest distance event, and now like you do really well in these beast distances? Like even just looking at your 2019 results, like as you were, the two races early were the flat, like Alabama and Jacksonville. And as the races progressed, you ended up doing much better. Like you were kind of at, 18th, 19th, 20th in those early races. But by the end at Tahoe, you finished 12th, and you were also 12th at West Virginia. So the North American and the World Championship at a much longer distance, you were able to make up a lot of place and time on some of your competitors. Did you foresee that happening? Why do you think that happened as the year progressed? Like, how did you feel like you got so much better as it kept going?
Part of it is how I plan out my seasons. When the season goes from February until September, that's long for me, and I can't maintain race shape for all those months. So I sort of prioritize what's most important. And, you know, in those years it was Tahoe for Worlds and West Virginia for the North American Championships. And I wanted to plan out my season so that I could peak at those races. And I really didn't care too much about the early races. I mean, I did, I was excited to go, but I was not overly concerned that I was coming in. I think last year at Jacksonville, I finished 11th, which was much better than 17th or so that I came in the first year I did that race. But I mean, I'm coming off of winter training, I host a running group on Tuesday evenings, and we do workouts. And during the winter season, we're on the track. In the summer, we're on the trails. And in the track, the university usually does a really good job of clearing the track for us, which is awesome. But not always, like, especially towards the holidays, you know, they're on their break. And sometimes I'll go out and clear it. But sometimes if it snows Tuesday afternoon and we meet Tuesday evening to run, we're running on the snow. So those workouts are usually pretty slow. Sometimes if we get a lot of snow, even when the university gets their large plows out on the track, they don't actually know where the track ends. So they might plow it in lane 3, and that's your tightest lane. And then you might still have a little bit of snow to run on. So a lot of those workouts are very much effort-based rather than knowing exactly what time we're running for what distance. So I'm coming off of that going into these very early season Spartan races. And it's more about having fun, getting used to being on obstacles again. I live in an apartment. I don't have my own rigs or anything like that. I have a staircase that I can use and
a bucket or something.
In a bar.
Yeah.
So a lot of that is kind of just learning how to go through the obstacles together or again. So that's definitely part of it, is the timing. And then the other component is exactly what you were saying with the distance. I think a large part of the reason why the longer races are better for me is simply because there's more running in between obstacles. Whenever we have shorter races, the obstacles are generally more tightly packed, and it's hard for me to go through a high density of obstacles. My obstacle proficiency just isn't as good as a lot of other people in the sport. Part of it is maybe my height. I'm 5 foot nothing. So where some people can skip rings and monkey bars, I'm like fully stretched out just getting to the next rung, which is fine. But I think it can slow me down sometimes in terms of just getting through a single obstacle. And I'm also kind of cautious on them, especially early in the season. And then a lot of times, like in between obstacles, I'm like, okay, I'm running again. I'm gaining more energy, because a lot of times those obstacles wipe me out more than I think some other people. I clearly need more practice on them. But yeah, just whenever there's more space to run between obstacles, like in a beast race, that's more geared to the athlete I am.
And that makes sense. Based on your strengths versus maybe the field strengths, like having more time off obstacles is going to be helpful when it comes to like where you're going to place against them. But one thing that you did touch on that I think is important to kind of dig into a little bit is talking about the idea of race shape and like when you're going to be sharp in terms of like how to peak for a race. And you said like the season is long, and you said it was long for you. It's long for anybody. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's just like way too much. And I think there are a select few people who seem to like build the season and peak really well for this, whereas it seems like the field kind of maintains throughout the entire year, and where they kind of start might be where they finish. And then there's people like you who end up kind of surpassing others. But a lot of times you'll see that people end up just kind of in the same spot because it's hard to really build and allow yourself to absorb the training without like over the course of 10 months. Like, it's just hard to really make this big progress. So to me, it seems there's a couple of things on that. Like, how do you maintain the discipline? I mean, you talked a little bit about how there's going to be some factors that might prevent you from being able to train at this really high level just based off like the weather and just like what you have in your area. But to me, it is about like having discipline with that, right? Like, you could probably still push yourself really hard for that race in Jacksonville or the second race year, wherever it is. And are you having that conversation with yourself to make sure that you're looking at the season from a holistic view? Or what is that kind of process like?
Yeah, I absolutely think about the season more holistically than perhaps some of the other racers, in that I definitely prioritize the end of the season races. To me, those are bigger championship races, and just my history being in college, we were always focused on nationals, and it was kind of like, we'll do our best at the early season invites, but we're really not very concerned about those. We want to make sure that everything we do this season allows us to compete our best at the national meet. And usually, I think for the first 3 years I was in college, we did terrible at Big Tens. And then it would be like, we tried hard, but our team just struggled at Big Tens. But it was because we were training for nationals and some of the other teams were training for the Big Ten championships. And by my senior year, my coach came in. We were at camp for the like early season cross country camp before school started. And he was just like, okay, I have a plan. We're going to hold our taper for, I think it's like 3 weeks or whatever it is between the conference meet and the national meet. And he's like, we always do poorly at Big Tens. Let's not do that this year. And so he had this plan that he drew up for us on a little easel, and it worked. What he had in our training plan worked really well. And we had our best finish at Big Tens. We finished second, really close to first place. And then as usual, we went on to do quite well at the national meet and beat all those Big Ten teams that would have beat us anyway. But yeah, so I take that learning experience and focus my interest on the world championships, and you know, whatever my big meet is for the year. Usually it's been Spartan Worlds. And I don't know that everybody else prioritizes the season the same. I don't know if everyone else really wants to do well at that meet, if they're happy just doing as best as they can at every single meet. Every single meet might be important to them, whereas I really don't care that much about how I finish in Jacksonville, just because I know I'm not planning to race well there. I'm planning to race well for where I'm at, but my long-term plan is not Jacksonville. That's like my rust buster race. And I know some people who can maintain racing throughout the year, you know, they want to do well at all of them. And it's just, I think a lot of it is just a different way of planning out the season.
And sometimes you got to think it's, if these people who are racing relatively well in all the events, like how much better they could potentially race at a championship event if they kind of planned out the season that way, or like how much results are they leaving on the table for their like peak performance, as opposed to like the consistency of just performing at like 90 to 95%. Like are they at 100% at these races, or are they just short? Like, you know, it's like kind of hard to tell those things without actually putting it into practice, which for some seems like a risk, right? Like, and you have the mindset right. of like your mindset is like, I'm going to show up and race as hard as I can, but know that physically I'm not going to be at my peak, just based off straight planning. And there's a difference there. You know, it's like, you could still like have a little taper for a race and like for a week and then race hard and do your best, but not be in the best possible shape that you're going to be in. And I think a lot of that comes down to like the training that you're doing around it. So when you're like gearing up for a Tahoe that's in like September or so, like when, like, how does it change your training, and like what, like when would you start for that?
Yeah. And I think just quickly before I jump into that, I think it is important to maybe mention that I think what works for me and what's fun for me might not be the same for other people. So if other people, you know, if they really, what's fun to them is to get out there and do the best they can at all of the races, and whatever is left at the end of the season for Tahoe is what they have. Like, that might be what allows them to have the most fun throughout the season. And I think that's great and they shouldn't change a thing. But if that's not fun for them, then definitely make some changes if they're not already.
That's a great point. Just to jump in on that as well. Like, yes, everyone's goals can be a little bit different, right? And like, if you want to do well in the national series, and like that's something that is going to be your number one over how you finish at Tahoe or whatever, like then you might have to adjust things. So I'm glad you brought that up. That goals, like however you adjust your season, it should be reflective on the goals and what you think is going to be fun and what's going to make you happy for sure. It's a good point.
Yeah. But sorry, I'm already forgetting your question. You were asking
how do you kind of build up, like when you know it's time to start to do like your hardest training, or what does it look like? Is it change? Does your intensity change? Is it like your volume that you kind of adjust? Like when you decide it's time to start training for peak performance, like what does that look like?
Yeah. So I break up my year a little bit. When I get into my kind of more focused racing season in the summer and my weights routine. So I do my more intense weights routine once a week, and that changes to a specific routine that, you know, I'll adjust throughout the summer season, but it's a little harder than what I do in what I call my more off season, which is kind of that October through March area of the year. So I kind of amp up on my strength training, and my running doesn't change a whole lot. I had a really major injury in college and have sustained, well, actually started in high school, and then it came back in college, and I have sustained trauma from that. And I run 47 miles a week. And if I try to run more than that consistently, things break down and my foot can stop functioning on me, which is terrifying. And I don't ever want that to happen again. So I stick with kind of 45 to 47. Every now and then I might bump up to 50. But if I do, I have to make sure to not do that for, you know, 2-3+ weeks in a row. I have to bring it back down. So my running doesn't change a whole lot. I do intensity, as I mentioned earlier, on Tuesdays. That's my biggest kind of workout day for running. And then I'll try and throw in a secondary intensity effort, maybe Thursday or Friday. And then my long run, depending on the day, it might be another intensity section. But it sometimes it's just get out and run long. And my long run is probably much shorter than many people listening. I usually do somewhere between like 11 and 14 miles for my long run. Sometimes on trails, sometimes on flats, but yeah, so my running stays fairly consistent throughout the year, but I tend to kind of put in maybe just a little bit more volume on intensity during the off season. It's kind of like, this is my time to really focus in on what I can train hard when, you know, there's more room to take risks and there's not really any high stakes in it. And, you know, maybe I'll have a big plan for myself, go out and try to do this big workout and just fall apart in it. And it's like, well, might be a hit to the confidence, but I've got another 6, 8, 12, you know, however many weeks until I have to race again. So if I'm feeling low confidence after this set of workouts that have just happened, like, it's okay. I've got time to build myself back up. So yeah, I'll usually get a little more intense, even though sometimes I can't actually measure what I'm doing in the winter, but a lot of times I can get a little more intense or try and do a little more volume in the winter and then tone it down just a tiny bit once I'm more in that race shape.
And are you kind of working it that way? I like the idea of like, yeah, take a risk. If you blow up, who cares? Like, doesn't mean it means nothing. It holds no value in terms of how you're going to perform. But also when you get closer to the races and you want to keep the volume and intensity a little bit more manageable, is that just for the sake of your health, do you think? Like, you just want to make sure that you're not overdoing it so your foot doesn't get to the point of like complete shutdown, or are you just more like specific on the things that you want to do leading into like the race?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Definitely as I move into that summer racing season, I want to try to do better with my technique training for obstacle things. So it's when I'm more consistently practicing a spear throw, which I don't have a target. I throw it against a hill that we're lucky to have at my apartment complex. And, but yeah, sometimes I'll go out and throw it in the snow too, but it's not as consistent. I don't really get on a rope or anything during that time. I am more consistent, not with the pandemic, but in times before that, I've been trying to get to a climbing gym, and I'm better at doing that in the summer when it just seems like there's more time. I'm a terrible climber, but I get on the wall and I, you know,
practice.
And it's tough because everybody in Bozeman is so good at climbing. And if I'm there by myself, I just feel like everybody's watching me and judging me, but that's kind of stupid. So
I always feel that same way. Well, the way I see it, because one time I went to a climbing gym in Seattle and I figured everybody there was going to be amazing, but it was much more for general fitness there. And it seemed like that I was just middle of the road. But for some reason here, like in Philadelphia, it's rock climbing is not really that big of a deal. So the people who go to the gyms are like really rock climbers, you know, they seek it out. So I'm okay with you. I'm like the worst by a million there. Just like, I just sit down, I'm like, it's fine. Blinders on. Don't look at what anybody else is doing. Nobody's looking at me.
Right. Yeah.
Like I said, it's good practice at least just to get on for the technique of things. And then how does that look like for, so does, Now, correct me if I'm wrong, then does your strength and like the skill and technique work, does that kind of fill in the total volume of things? Because like you mentioned, your running doesn't necessarily change. Like you're kind of hamstrung by like the amount that you could do and the intensity that you do. And that seems to be, you're doing a lot more intensity, or you're keeping intensity kind of consistent or present throughout the year. But when it gets closer to like peak training, you're adding more time in the weight room and like technique stuff?
Yeah, pretty much. I mostly do all my weight training at home, which I'm sure could be improved because we don't have a home gym or anything. We've got a few plates that I work with and a bucket full of rocks. And like, I'll get out and I'll work with those. And like the days that I work with those doesn't change throughout the year, but yeah, definitely when I'm more focused on race training, that, like you said, I think that volume of strength training increases a little bit so that my overall total volume of, I guess you could call it intensity, is a little bit higher. But to kind of circle back on something you mentioned a little while ago, that kind of week taper before a race, week as in W-E-E-K, 1 week.
Yeah.
taper, not mini taper. I do follow that pretty strongly. Like I'll cut my running volume down by about 75% the week of a race.
Wow.
By 25%, I'll do 75% of my running.
Okay. I was like, man, yeah. You just go out for like a run on Monday and just like,
yeah. No, yeah. Quantitative biologist here can't even talk percentages. I'll cut that down to doing 75% of my normal running. And then my weight training will be cut down by about the same amount. And then to recover from the race, I'll usually cut my strength training by half, and then running oftentimes will be back up to that 47-ish miles. Unless I'm really feeling tired, then I'll make some cuts throughout the week and just say, okay, I'm not recovering as well as I thought I'd be. Maybe I need to run really easy and really short today and I'll feel better tomorrow.
It's a nice benefit to having the mileage be like middle of the road, right? Like it's not like the consistency of it. You're never necessarily needing to have to go really high, really low. Like even like, yeah, you take 25% off of that week. It's not too much down. And you can get right back into it. So in terms of like being consistent, which is usually like the best way to improve, that's an interesting byproduct of having it that way. So you're not needing to build up like crazy. You don't need to be really, really careful when you're kind of building back up after a race. You're able to kind of pull it back from the strength.
These are really for the summer races too. For the earlier season, I don't even bother with that. I'll cut down on my strength training some, but my running doesn't change a whole lot.
That just feels nice sometimes. Just to not taper, you're like, fine, good. I'm just going to go and keep training and just run this race. And that'll be it.
Yeah, my body doesn't always respond super well to tapers either. So like if I take a really strong taper, my body's just, oh, we're on break. Okay.
Let's just go all the way conserve it all. It's more my brain. Like I just don't like the way, like regrettably, it's probably not that awesome that I don't feel great if I'm not doing a lot, but that's kind of how I feel going into a race. I'm like, oh, I'm just feeling kind of sluggish and not at my peak here. Which isn't always great, but, so I like the approach you have. It's an interesting way to kind of look at the season from a big picture, and you really know yourself well, right? Like ultimately that's what it comes down to. Like, you know exactly what's going to work for you. You've done a lot of different things and you kind of have yourself figured out in that way. So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned your career there just briefly. So you have an interesting job. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I'm a wildlife biologist and I mostly do quantitative work. So I'm sort of like a pretend statistician with the disguise of a biologist, because I definitely don't know anywhere near as much knowledge as a true statistician, but most of my day is doing statistical modeling to understand. I mostly work with marine mammals, but do a little bit of some other wildlife species. I'm getting into some sea duck work right now, but also working with harbor seals currently. And so my current projects, I'm looking to see in the Salish Sea off the coast of Washington, that kind of northwest area, which is a completely new ecosystem to me as of this past like late summer, early fall. So it's been cool to get to know, but we're looking to see where the harbor seals are most likely to be hanging out in this Salish Sea ecosystem and what's kind of driving their behavior for being in these areas. Is it the temperature? Is it the salt content of the water? Is it this just happens to be where all the salmon are and they're hungry for salmon? And then what's driving the salmon? Because we can't directly measure where salmon are with the resources that we have. Is it the tide cycle? Is it that they're really close to a freshwater input from a river? Or maybe this just has a really nice beach for them to go lay out on. So a lot of different things that we're putting into these models to see what are some of the best predictors for where these seals are going to be hanging out in this habitat.
It seems like it's such like a sliding doors thing. I don't know if that's how with it, with all of the projects that you kind of get on, but like, I'm sure like once you find information on one thing, it leads to some other question that you need to kind of dive in and find out and like so on. Like just even like your explanation there, like what you're doing, it's like relates to the salmon and like, where are they coming from? And is that ideally the purpose? Like what, when you find the answers to these things, like how did you start on like a specific project or this project? And what are you hoping to accomplish when like figuring out these habits and patterns?
Yeah. So kind of like you said, it is, I think a lot of science in general is definitely this sliding door concept where you start with a research question and then that just turns into six other questions, and then you've got to pick one to start with. And then that can branch off into different things too. So, you know, it's really funny. Some people build an entire career on a very small section of, you know, biology or whatever discipline they're in, but they know that system super, super well, which is really cool. And yeah, so I got onto this project. It's soft money, so it's grant funded through a somewhat local funding source out in the Seattle area. And so our goal with the project is really to make these really comprehensive maps from our models to be able to understand, you know, if we're in this section of the water, we can kind of expect to see this range of numbers of harbor seals versus over here, there might be way more. And over in this other section, there might be just a few. And that's going to be useful for managing the ecosystem in general and trying to help facilitate a good balance among all of the organisms living in the Salish Sea. So a lot of what I do is more theoretical based. So just learning about the basic science behind what's driving some patterns. This project is very much applied where we can find some general patterns that might be applied to a bunch of other organisms, but our main goal is focused on harbor seals in the Salish Sea. Where are they hanging out and in what kinds of densities are they hanging out in these areas?
And then that could ideally give you an understanding of kind of what, like you mentioned, like the ecosystem and what's happening with everything. So if there's something happens that's abnormal within these patterns that you're kind of like uncovering, like would that then lead, that could then lead to some sort of discovery or some sort of like warning sign or something, like Is that also kind of the idea? It's like, if we can understand exactly how this behavior is when it changes, then you can kind of go look for other things as to why it has changed. Is that kind of behind the idea behind it too?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important to understand kind of at a baseline level, how does an ecosystem work so that, or even just a single population of one species. Because yeah, when there is some kind of disturbance, whether it's a weird weather anomaly or an oil spill or, you know, deforestation, whatever might be happening, forest fires, which are unfortunately really bad this past year, and can even leak into the marine ecosystems, which I just learned that a few weeks ago, which I never realized that could be an aquatic problem. I thought it was always a terrestrial problem. But yeah, it's important to understand when things are good, how does this system function versus, okay, now we have this big problem that nobody foresaw coming. How can we kind of mitigate this disturbance to help protect the organisms living in this area? And then that leads into what are we as humans gaining from the ecosystem? Because, you know, there's a huge commercial fishing industry in the Salish Sea. So they want to make sure that they can still pull out the salmon and other fish species at the appropriate numbers so that there's enough fish left in the water for the other animals and for humans to come back year after year and continue to take fish out of that system. So yeah, there's a very delicate balance to all of this, and the work that we do and the work that a ton of other researchers do on other components and other species, that all kind of works together to build up our knowledge base of what's going on and how do people need to respond when things don't go so well.
Yeah. Like, it's like being able to like live in this type of real world, like systems thinking has to be so eye-opening for like how everything works, you know, cause you could just sit here and just like see one thing and just leave it as an example of like that, this isolated incident of what the individual sees. But like, you are literally entrenched in this massive system that is not just beyond like where the behavior of these seals, but like, and how it like branches out and affects all this other stuff around. It has to be really interesting, really cool.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I think it's just also a really good parallel to training, because it's really easy to think of yourself training in a vacuum, but that's not how fitness works. And, you know, if you're out doing something on Monday, March, what is it? The 15th? Yeah. Monday, March 15th, 2021. Well, my training today is going to be impacted by what I've done the past couple of weeks, and what I do today is going to affect what I do in the next several days to a couple of weeks in the future. So you have to think about everything as how it relates to others. And if I'm training by myself versus training with other people, that has additional connections and impacts too. So yeah, I like finding connections between my athletic life and my working life. I think that helps me understand both of them a little deeper.
At least gives you like having that understanding that all these things are connected, it can help with like the bigger picture, which is easy to get lost, you know, especially it's like, oh, I felt bad today, I'm in bad shape. Like, it's like, yeah, you just slept maybe poorly the past 2 days or had some food that you didn't quite agree with. So that has to help with like the patience of things. And so I don't know if this was my elementary school in particular, or if there was like a popular person in my elementary school that just said like, I want to be a marine biologist. But for some reason, everybody when I was like in third or fourth grade was like, I want to be a marine biologist. And maybe that's just something that my personal experience, but has this always been like something that you've been driven to, or is this type of thinking always been part of your personality as far as you can remember? Or like, how did you kind of like get to here?
Yeah, I fell in love with Florida manatees at a very young age. My grandmother used to live in Florida, and so we would take a vacation to go visit her at least once a year, oftentimes twice a year. And it was always a treat if we could go see the manatees or even just something related to manatees, like going to a restaurant that has the word manatee in its title. Really, really excited. And my grandma and my parents got me all these manatee stuffed animals growing up, most of which I still have. And like that just kind of became part of my identity, I think. And my sister actually gave me this, it's like a sign that says I'm a manatee trapped in a human body. And I think it's pretty fitting for me. But yeah, I just really fell in love with their behavior because they're so gentle. And it's funny because they're also really slow and I'm a runner, so that doesn't really fit. But they're a really kind animal. They're really gentle. They don't have any natural predators, and they themselves are not really predators. They have an almost completely vegetarian or herbivorous diet, but they actually sometimes do eat like some little crustacean barnacle-y things. But generally they're eating plants. And so I think as humans, it's always easier for us to think, oh, it's only eating plants, it's a nice animal, versus, you know, the grizzly bears and the wolves are going after the elk and the deer. And it's like, oh, they're not as nice of animals because right. they're eating these pretty animals that we also like. It's like, well, wait a minute, plants are important too. They have feelings. We don't communicate in chemicals, so we can't hear them screaming. But well, we do communicate in chemicals. We're just not as finely
not in tune with it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I just really love manatees. And then from maybe kindergarten on, people ask me, oh, what do you want to do when you grow up? I'm going to save the manatees. And that kind of just stayed with me through high school. I was like, yeah, I'm going to save the manatees. And then I was like, wait, I actually need to assign a career to this. And so when I was in college, I studied integrative biology, which is just, they had two tracks. One was like more molecular and one was more ecology based, and they called it integrative. So I studied that, and then that was in central Illinois, so not a whole lot of marine stuff going on there. But I learned a lot about biology in general. And then my master's degree was in South Carolina, and that was coastal marine and wetland systems was the name of that degree. So it was all about the marine world. And I learned a ton about marine life in general. And it was really cool because it wasn't just biology. They included physical, geological, and chemical information in with that degree. So that was super cool to get a more holistic picture of what's going on in these systems rather than just studying one population or even just focusing on the biology. I think that was super useful for my just my general knowledge of biology in my career. And then my PhD was more focused on biology, but my dissertation was on Weddell seals in Antarctica. So that got me to continue with the marine system as well.
So do you think that the drive to work in this capacity led you to learn how to think this way? Or do you think that like your thinking of like systems and the whole holistic piece was something that was inherent to you, and one way or another, you were going to be in this type of field, regardless of what like the primary focus would be?
That is a great question. That's really hard to decouple because it's been with me for so long, but I can definitely see moving through my career path how learning about all of these different connections. And I think it was really solidified in my PhD when I did my comprehensive exams, which can take on a lot of different forms. And for me, my committee was very focused on, we want you to understand how your project fits into the entire world of biology and how does this system in the Ross Sea in Antarctica affect what goes on throughout the rest of the Southern Ocean, but also in a global sense. Like, how does Antarctica start, like those temperature differences and those salinity differences, how does that cause some of these different currents throughout the ocean? And that, you know, how does that affect these global currents? So it really got me thinking about, you know, I'm spending years focused on this one population of seals, and not even the whole population. I was only focused on the males. So I'm thinking about things at a very, very fine level. And then it was like, okay, now for the next few weeks while you study for these comprehensive exams, think about things at a really broad level. And I'm probably a weirdo in saying this, but I really enjoyed my comprehensive exams and the whole thing leading up to them, because it was just me jumping into these textbooks, jumping into peer-reviewed literature, and just learning about things that I was interested in and making those connections back to my population that I was studying. And that was super interesting to me. So then when it came time to do the exam, I had, for the written part, like, I was just writing and writing and writing. I was like, oh, I have to tell them about this cool thing that I learned, and I have to connect that to this other cool thing. And then for the oral part, you know, they really stretched my mind in other ways too. And they're like, yeah, but how does this connect with this thing happening way over in California? And I was like, I don't know, guys, give me a second. And, you know, like, and they would help me think it through. And that was super cool to me. And I took those, I don't know, 3 years ago, maybe. And that stuck with me through everything else that I've done so far. And I'm like, well, wait, I'm running down Main Street right now. How does that connect to 100 other things that are about me and about other people and about the street itself? So yeah, just a different way of looking at the world.
I was just going to ask you, then are you able to do that with training? Like, are you looking at OCR and like being able, if I can do this fine skill, like how would that, like, are you able to look at the very pinpoint and the broad? Do you use that in terms of your training as well?
Yeah, I certainly try to. Yeah, and it's kind of like, well, if I can do this one thing that's, you know, going to help me throw the spear, I am terrible at throwing, so I really need to accelerate into that throw. Well, how does that translate into another obstacle? Oh, well, if I'm trying to get over this 8-foot wall, which is a challenge for me, or jump up and catch the A-frame, which, or not the cargo one, the
beat bender?
No,
the platform.
All the names get to
vertical
me
vertical cargo?
No, it's the one you have to jump. Oh, Stairway to Sparta. You have to like jump up and catch top of that before you can climb up it. And that one's really difficult for me. I think I spent 10 minutes on it in Tahoe, and it was a really dumb decision for me to do that. And then
burpeed that. Yeah. Oh, you still did burpees.
I can do it. And I was like, you know, I put like maybe a minute or two on Rhea and Rose, and I was like, oh yeah, I got to get this obstacle. And like, I've tried it like 10 times, and then they come through, and it took them a little bit, but they got it. And then I'm still there several minutes later, and I was like, this is not the right thing to do. But yeah, you know, learning from, hey, this is the thing that I really needed to improve in the spear throw was the acceleration component. I need to take that and apply that to the Stairway to Sparta and get a better acceleration going into that. And that's going to allow me to jump higher and hopefully complete that obstacle. So yeah, I think that has been useful to make those connections between what I had to learn to do one obstacle to apply that to another one.
Yeah. So I have been thinking about this often recently, is like how to take like the very granular in OCR and like, where is the, like, how is the time best spent, right? Like, if you can get the really fine details of like, you know, your form about how to get over a wall and just like really dial that in and just like focus on just like one piece, right? Like, as opposed to just doing I don't know, some like more like general training, like where is that the benefit and how would that be helpful to kind of put into like a training program of like these like fine skilled movements? But it sounds like it's something that you have put thought into and have done. Do you attribute a lot of your success to this kind of thinking, or have you ever thought about it that way? Like how you ended up being so good at obstacle course racing?
I think it's definitely the approach I take to learning about it, because I coach myself and my husband coaches me, which when I first started coaching at the university level, somebody I was working with who is a very accomplished runner herself. She's like I think 2-time Canadian record holder in the 10K and the 5K, definitely the 10K. I could be wrong about the 5K, and a former Olympian, and just believes in her athletes and just has so much. She puts so much of her, you know, interest into helping these athletes. Like, it was great for me to learn from her. But something that she told me that really stuck with me was, it's useful to, when you get to the elite level, you kind of know all of the pieces that you need to do to be successful, but it's helpful to have somebody else to act as a coach because they're going to get you to do the things you don't want to do. You're going to do the things you want to do all the time.
Right.
Of course, if you're going to make it to that level, you hopefully enjoy the sport. And, you know, they're the ones who, number one, they can see you from an outside perspective, and they're not the ones going through all of the difficult training. So if you're maybe giving yourself a little bit too easy of a time, they can jump in and be like, well, I think you can do this. I don't think you need to skip this part. But also they're going to come in and say, this workout's going to be very useful for you. And you're like, I know, but I hate that one. It's like, yeah, it's okay. Just do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then also they can help you come up with strategy. And so my husband, who helps coach me, does not have a running background. He has a wrestling background. So he knows way more about strength than I do. And he is like an ultimate strategist, which I'm not. So he's been really helpful as a coach for me to learn how to get through some of these obstacles, or, you know, if it's 3 things stacked in a row or even more, you know, then he can tell me before the race, like, oh, here's a good plan coming into this gauntlet of what you might want to do. Or just different things when I'm training, like, hey, you didn't accelerate through that throw. That's why it wound up sideways and short. And it's like, oh, okay. It felt like I was accelerating, but you saw that I wasn't. So now I need to make a change. So yeah, I think that can be really helpful.
Yeah. And being able to think of it, like how everything's going to affect you throughout the race is going to be helpful. And having that plan in place, and yeah, having a good strategist, I'm sure is helpful. Cause even just like the way you told me about how you approached Tahoe last year, and just like you thought out the best way to stay warm, you know, you're just like, this is probably what I'm going to have to do. I don't like the cold, and I'm going to have to do X, Y, Z stuff to make sure I get through the race. And that was like a huge strategy, like that worked. And like a lot of people didn't put that time or didn't even consider that to be something that they could even think about doing. And even on any obstacle, it's like, I don't know, I'll get up here and I'll just get over it however I can, as opposed to thinking about like ways to actually do it. So I think that is, it's really cool that you will spend that time and like learning and figuring out how to make that all work. So what are you thinking for this year? We don't know when races are going to go. It's seemingly becoming more optimistic, but we're not quite sure. So what do you think for this year? What do you got in terms of goals?
Yeah. I usually try to plan my racing schedule around the U.S. National Series, and then do the North American Championships, and then have the big dance at Tahoe, which this year will not be the World Championships. But I think that will most likely be my final OCR race of the season anyway. I'm not quite ready to go to the Middle East yet. So I think I'm going to finish off at the North American Championships in Tahoe this year. And do as many of the U.S. National Series races as I can. I did not do Jacksonville. I'm just really kind of a paranoid person, so I'm not ready to get out and be in the world yet.
Quite while we're still in the pandemic. Yeah.
So, I was definitely had some feelings of like, oh man, everybody's having so much fun. I wish I could be there. And my family's living in Florida, not anywhere near Jacksonville, but you know, it's a nice time. The past couple of years I got to see them. So like that whole trip is super fun for me, but so looking to start racing, I think in May with the Montana, I think it's a super I was thinking about doing. It's the local race for me. It's about 5-hour drive,
right. But
it's about as local as you can get when you live in such a big state. Kind of take that and then do hopefully the rest of the US series. And yeah, I mean, I would love to. I cracked into the top 10 a couple times last year. Actually, I think it ended up being once because I got burpee penalties for the other time. So I made it into the top 10s once last year. I'd like to be more consistent with that and just keep moving up those numbers and yeah, just see what I can do.
Yeah. Would you do the slow race? Cause that's going to be a US National Series after Tahoe, right? That's going to be in November now. Did you see that?
Yeah. I had signed up to do that initially when it was in April. So yeah. So I guess I misspoke. I think that would be my final race. I'm currently signed up for it. So might as well. I don't have anything else going on then.
Right. And that's, again, it's a tricky thing because it's like Tahoe and you're like, all right, cool. I'm good. I'll be able to relax for a little bit. But then you have this other race that's coming up that happened to like in the mountain series a couple of times, like the races after like the last big race. So you just get there and like, all right, fine. We'll just get through it. What place were you in before Stairway to Sparta at Tahoe? Were you in like 9th or 10th?
Probably. I honestly didn't know where I was throughout most of that race. I just remember I was terrified to get in the swim as I was coming through the sandbag, the long sandbag carry that I think it was a double. Mm-hmm. And one of my best friends had come to the race and he was not too far after the sandbag and he was cheering me on and I was like, Damon, I'm afraid about the swim. And he's like, just run to Patrick, who's my husband. He's like, Patrick's waiting for you at the swim. So like he took away the option for me to not go there, which was phenomenal. I needed that because I was watching. I watched, you know, Faye Stenning drop out during the sandbag. She was just a little bit in front of me and I watched her walk off the course and I watched a couple other women I didn't know do the same thing. And I was like, oh man, am I okay to keep doing this? Or am I gonna like sustain some severe damage here? Because I'm not good at staying warm. And yeah, so I got to the swim and my husband was just like, all right, you know, you're fine. You're good to keep going. And I was still a little on the fence because in my head that water was going to be freezing cold because it was at the top of the mountain when we had jump in it first. And Ashley Heller came up behind me and like gave me a little push and she's like, come on, Jamie. And she had absolutely no fear jumping in that water. And I was like, all right, well, if Ashley's good, then I should do it, which is also helpful. And yeah. And then I jumped in, I was like, oh, this water's really warm compared to the 25 degrees or whatever it was we're running in. Sorry, I'm making this answer to your question really long, but,
keep it going. I like hearing these stories. Did you do it? Did you do a dry bag or what'd you do? Did you just go in?
I tried a dry bag my first year, which was 2017, and it ended up being warm. So I never even put those clothes back on. And when I had more bulky clothes, I was like, I can't fit this in my sports bra. I don't know where to put it. And my husband was like, what if we just put on some neoprene on your top? So I wore a neoprene top because yes, it's going to get wet. Yes, it's going to keep being wet, but the water against my skin from wearing that only had to be warmed once by my body. It wasn't like it was constantly being wicked away and then some more water could come onto it. It was held in there from the neoprene top. So yeah, everything that I wore in that race stayed on me the whole time. And I just wore things that could get wet and not continue to get me colder. Like when I was training in Antarctica, like training to work in Antarctica, not training for
Tahoe. Do a training block in Antarctica.
Yeah. No, not something they'd let you do. But you know, they told us, they're like, they had this phrase, cotton kills. And it was just getting at the idea that if you wear a cotton fabric, then it's going to hold on to that moisture and it's going to keep you cool, which could be helpful in the summer. But, you know, in a situation like Tahoe, that would be something that would be really detrimental to me. So, you know, I was like, okay, I can't wear cotton. You know, what other fabrics are still going to be insulating when things are wet and cold? So we just planned it out that way. And I need to credit my husband for most of that. He has a fantastic strategic mind, and he knew so much about just what I needed to do to stay warm. He always does. He always is the one who brings the jacket, and I think I'm going to be fine. And then he's like, here's the jacket you weren't going to bring.
Thank you for thinking this through. Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, just planning for that was really useful. And then I was coming down the mountain, and I heard Rhea coming behind me because I was stuck on the 8-foot wall, and I could hear her shivering. And that was really scary to me, but she seemed fine. And I think I asked her too. She's like, oh, I'm good. And she was moving. So she was. And in my head, I was kind of like, I'm not as cold as Rhea. I'm fine. I need to keep moving and keep competing. And so we ran a little bit of the race together, coming down the rest of the mountain and going through whatever was at the base of it. It was like a monkey
that twister. Monkey twister deal. Yeah. There's like,
yeah, whatever the
Helix was down there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were going through those together. We both failed the monkey twister monkey, and I practiced burpees almost like usually 4 or 5 times a week because I'm not good at obstacles and I know I'm going to do burpees. So I better practice them. So I out burpeed her, but not by much, because I think she entered it a little bit before me. And then there was somebody, a volunteer at that obstacle, and he's like, oh, you girls look great. Some of the girls up ahead, they look colder than you. Go catch them. And so that was really nice of him. And it gave us a little encouragement. So yeah, we were running kind of together, and then we saw Rose, and then we kept going, and then came into that Stairway to Sparta, where they both blew past me like it was nothing. And yeah, I think they went on to pass a couple more girls. So they ended up like 7th and 8th or 8th and 9th or something like that. So yeah, we were probably right around 10th at that point.
Yeah.
But it was funny because aside from those girls, by that point in the race, I didn't see anybody. After Stairway to Sparta, I did not see anybody ahead of me. I did not see anybody behind me. So
that's a good two miles at least.
Place?
Yeah. yeah. But how'd you feel about that finish then?
Really good. I was very pleased with it. Mostly I was pleased that I made it through the race and was still alive. And because I went into it and I was like, okay, I really want to do well at this race, but it's the coldest conditions I've ever raced in. And well, it's the coldest conditions I've ever raced in while having to get wet. I did a 5K in Antarctica, which kind of counts, but
we'll count it. Yeah. Semantics though.
Yeah. And you know, and I was kind of like, before the race, I told my husband, I was like, if I am not looking okay coming in or coming out of that swim, please just pull me. And I was fully prepared to not finish that race if that was going to be the smartest move to, you know, just keep me healthy. But of course, I really wanted to finish the race and do well. So when I found out that I was 12th and not last, I was super stoked.
Right. Much better than last.
I remember being at the finish line and my husband came in and gave me tea to warm up, which was great. And I had to take off those clothes and I basically just took off all my clothes at the finish line and put on dry clothes. And I'm like, I'm sorry.
Just had to do it.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to die if I don't do this. And nobody cared.
Everybody else is doing the same thing. Everybody else is like, I don't think I'm dead yet. I think I'm all right. Yeah. Everyone's just trying to get through it. Well, cool. Well, I'm really excited to see whenever races happen again, how things are going to kind of play out. Like I said, like you've had some really good progress, even year over year. Like I just mentioned, we talked mostly about 2019, about how kind of where you started and where you finished, but even the previous years, like your current, like where you finish, has improved year over year. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. Thank you.
So yeah, so it could be a big year, 2021. I'm looking forward to seeing it, and we'll make sure to keep everybody updated on your progress and everything, for your hometown race, whenever that, when that comes through. Cool. So I'll make sure to link to all your socials and everything. I guess we'll just leave it at that.
Awesome. Thank you. Good luck to you too.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to hit stop here and then we'll just be back in that first thing. Cool. All right. Well, we'll see you.